Lieutenant Amers smiled up at Carlyle. We usually eat ordinary food, and sawing hunks off a giant strawberry or eating a gingerbread house from inside out is every bit as fun as you'd imagine, but sometimes one just wants to break bread like a normal person. Carlyle's eyes were bright with wonder as he leaned low over the bucket. I can understand that. Where's Bridger?
Looking at a nest of baby birds.
The major pointed to some brush nearby, where the boy crouched, half-hidden by the stems. As when a mountain climber on some cloud-locked peak grows so weary that he forgets the world around him in the pain and pull and pain and pull, aware of nothing but his muscles, fog, and stone. But then suddenly a bright wind sweeps the clouds aside, and there open the boundless blue heavens, the sentinel heads of mountains thrusting through the fog floor, and the climber gasps as he sees, sovereign up above, the terrible, all-giving sun. So Carlyle gasped at the sight of Bridger. And so he should. So should we all. Have they? He whispered when his breath returned. Did they make the decision yet? Whether to bring back the one who died?
They wanted to talk to you first.
Carlyle's pale brows arched in wonder at the brave patience of this little boy. One question for you first.
Just one?
The major teased. One above all. Can you tell me whether this is Bridger's first taste of death? The first time one of the animated toys has died? Apart from the person in the photograph, I heard about that. A veteran's sigh is always heavy.
No. But this is the first time since Bridger was old enough to understand. There were men from both sides in the soldier playset. When he first animated us, we didn't understand what was going on. There were some casualties in the minutes before we managed to spot the giant 3-year-old in the sky and call a truce. Back then, Bridger didn't know enough of the world to understand resurrection, and we didn't manage to keep the corpses.
You fought each other?
Green versus yellow.
The major nodded to Stander Y, who still wore the desert beige of the opposing force.
The world has seen more causeless wars.
Carlyle's brow furrowed in sympathy.
We all remember our war, the major continued. The rage of it, the cities, families that never quite existed. My men are eager to talk to you, too. But they've waited this long and can wait longer. It's the boy that matters most.
He turned and shouted toward the brush.
Bridger, come, it's time.
Bridger rose from the bushes and approached, his clothing studded with chaff and seeds. Did I not describe him properly before? His clothes were almost as loose as a cousin's, a rough, woven child's wrap with broad blue stripes, oversized enough for his hands to hide in the frayed sleeves, and baggy canvas play pants, once khaki but grass-stained to a mottled chaos no printed camouflage can match. His face was perfect as an angel's. It's not just a pseudo-parent's love that makes me say so. Even the sloppy clothes could not conceal his fine limbs, slim and lively, like when Cupid is painted as a youth, fragile in Psyche's arms, instead of as a pudgy infant. His skin was light, but not too light, and luminous, like wheat soap. His hair not pure blonde, but a pale brown graced with blonde, like an antique bronze whose gilding is not completely worn away. If Bridger had had parents, they must have been of European stock, but he seemed more a painter's fantasy than any mother's son. They have a tracker, Carlyle observed as the boy approached, marking the device clipped over his right ear.
Yes, Thisbe answered. They have to look like a normal kid in case someone spots them. But it's not on the network. Jury-rigged. No record.
The witch smiled softly at the child, who dragged his feet as he approached, as if each longed to hide behind the other. Come here, honey, she coaxed. I brought you something, too. Mycroft, I know thou intendest this descriptor witch to make me uncomfortable, but thou succeedest too well. Some archaisms are nuanced, others merely gross. Kindly leave out this slur against both Thisbe and those good people in history who really did call themselves witches. As you command, good reader, I obey. Bridger grinned. Is it a pretzel? Way to spoil the surprise. Thisbe took out the surprise, fresh in its packet from the Mennonite reservation in Pennsylvania. Does it have cinnamon sugar? Maybe it does. Better taste it to make sure. He dashed close enough to seize the treat, then hid behind Thisbe, eyeing the sensei as a cat eyes a new footstool intruding in its living room. Carlyle crouched to face the boy more evenly. Hello, Bridger. Thank you for agreeing to see me again. Bridger opened the pretzel, wrinkling his cherub nose at the steam. We're supposed to talk about if I should bring Pointer back. Carlyle sat back on his heels. All right. Thisbe said senseiing is supposed to be private, but I want to have the Major listen, to be safe. That's fine, if it's what you want. And Thisbe too. And Mycroft's going to listen on my tracker. That's fine. It's not strange for you to be nervous the first time. And Lieutenant Aimer, too, and Crawler, and No Gun, and Medic, and No Stand, and Standard Y, and Standard G, but not Looker. Looker's on lookout. And not Croucher. Croucher's back with Mama Doll. Carlyle made his chuckle warm. That's quite an audience. Is that against the rules? Not if it's what makes you feel safe. But you and I will be the two that talk. The others will just listen to make sure you're okay. All right? You too shall join us, reader. You may feel like a voyeur, invading this intimacy which only the most scandalous movie dares depict. I know your fear, that if you find yourself agreeing, two of a kind in the same faith, you will have taken your first step toward a church, and the bigotry and violence churches vomit forth. But you must come. This will be the gentlest of sessions, as Carlyle takes a child down the many paths of skepticism, not to conclusions, but to questions. I will show you worse in time, but you will never understand this history if you do not dare read about another's God. Croucher says you're going to blab and damn us all, and the cousins will take me away and lock Mycroft up, and Thisbe will get put on trial, and Boo will get dissected, and the army men will be locked in an evil lab forever and ever, and they'll torture me and make me some horrible thing that'll wipe out the world. I can't tell with Carlyle whether his easy smiles are trade tricks he learned at the conclave, or whether he is so sweet by nature. That won't happen. It won't? No. Mycroft and Thisbe and everyone are taking every precaution, and I'm not going to tell any bad people about you, no matter what. I promise. Bridger's light brows furrowed as he weighed the stranger's promise. Bridger, can we have a quick miracle over here? It was No Gun who called, his voice cracking like an adolescent who should not yet be allowed in uniform. Yup. The child reached between the soldiers and touched the nearest of the plastic dishes. Without sound or pomp, a glistening realness spread across the food, as when a dying man's eyes lose their sparkle, but reversed. Feasting and feast's happy murmur followed. Bridger settled in the grass facing Carlyle and buried his arms in the folds of his sloppy sleeves. "I've been thinking," he began, "about how I'd bring Pointer back, if I decide to. I could make a Frankenstein machine and throw the switch, and it would zap them to life. And that way it would be science that did it, not magic. So I wouldn't break science or anything. But then they might come back as a zombie monster. Or I could make a magic resurrecting thing like the Holy Grail or a unicorn horn or mermaid blood or phoenix blood. But things like that might have side effects. Not just on Pointer. Carlyle thought for some moments, which I took as a good sign, patience and digestion before he ventured words. Then, have you decided definitely to bring them back? The child frowned at his pretzel. I want to, but I feel like I'm not supposed to. Like it's not allowed. That's a very natural feeling, the sensei assured. You don't know what it means to bring them back. You don't know how life and death work, if there are some invisible rules you would be breaking. Anybody would be nervous. I'm nervous too. Bridger munched his pretzel. You're nervous? Mm-hmm. I have to do a good job helping you decide, just like you have to do a good job deciding. So we're both nervous. That makes sense. Bridger scratched a small rut in the soil with his shoe. Are there rules to death? Thisbe retreated to the sidelines now, exchanging glances with the major, like parents hovering on the first day of kindergarten. Some people think there are rules to death. Other people think there aren't. The child's frown disapproved of something, and by his eager munching, it wasn't the pretzel. If there are rules, would it be like karma? The sensei nodded at the term. Yes, karma is a good example of a rule some people think death has, and reincarnation. Do you know what reincarnation is? That's when you live again and again. Carlyle nodded, watching carefully the movements of Bridger's eyes, the fidgeting of his feet, signposts of the subtle border between discussion and discomfort. People have a lot of different ideas of different ways that reincarnation and karma might work, he continued. If they do exist, then they might have rules, and by bringing Pointer back, you might affect those rules in some way. Similarly, if there is an afterlife that dead people go to, then there could be rules about that, and you might affect those rules. And there might also be rules for this world that would be affected. Lots of possibilities. Rules for this world? Yes. Some people think there are metaphysical rules for this world, just like people think there could be for an afterlife. For example, do you know what providence is? That everything happens for a reason. Yes, that's right. And specifically, that everything happens for a good reason. There are lots of different philosophies that believe in some kind of providence. So, providence is rules for this world, like heaven and Hades is rules for the afterlife. Yes, possibly, Carlyle confirmed gently. Remember, these are things some people think. You have to decide for yourself what you think. And you don't have to decide quickly. You can take lots of time to talk and think. If there is providence, and everything that happens is for a good reason, then that could mean that Pointer died for a good reason. So it's good that Pointer died, and it would be bad to bring them back. Or it might be that Providence made you have the powers you have, partly because Pointer was going to die, and Providence intends you to bring Pointer back. So, bringing them back would be good. The boy frowned. That's backwards of itself. Yes, well put. It's difficult to figure out what to do if you believe in Providence. Even among the people who believe in Providence, which is only some, there are lots of different ideas about how Providence might work. And Providence is just one of many kinds of rules some people think the world might have. Or it might have none at all, and just be chaos. He leaned forward toward the boy. With so many possibilities, it's important to be patient, and give yourself lots of time to think. Bridger, I was thinking that maybe I shouldn't bring Pointer back if there's an afterlife, but if there isn't an afterlife, then I really, really should. Carlyle, perhaps, but it doesn't have to be binary like that. For example, some people think there is an afterlife, but that it's better to be alive than to be in the afterlife. Bridger, A bad afterlife? Like hell? Carlyle, hell is one famous example, but there are other examples. Some people believe in afterlives that aren't full of torment, but still aren't as good as being alive. And some people don't believe in an afterlife at all, but still believe in karma, or providence, in rules about life, and think that you shouldn't interfere with those rules. The boy's brows knitted. Then I should bring Pointer back if there's a bad afterlife, or no rules, but I shouldn't bring them back if there's a good afterlife, or rules? Except, how do I know if there's rules?
It may or not be possible to know for sure. But either way, it usually takes a long time and a lot of thinking to figure out if you think there are rules or not.
But, he added, seeing a flare of fidgeting proclaim the boy's discomfort, there are some people who don't believe in rules, and don't believe in an afterlife, but would still say death isn't bad. The last nugget of pretzel vanished now, and Bridger summoned Boo into his lap, a mass of blue fur and affection. How could death be not bad if there's no afterlife? I mean, you're dead. No more you. That's bad. Carlyle stretched, letting his body signal relaxation to the child, if not his words. Have you heard of the Epicureans? They're an interesting example. Bridger sniffed. Croucher called Crawler an Epicurean because he likes food too much. Carlyle. That's one way the word is used, but it also refers to a philosophy from ancient Greece. Bridger. Did Epicureans invent the Bash? Carlyle. Yes, sort of. You sure know a lot. He smiled his praise. Neo-Epicureans invented the Bash. Neo-Epicureans lived many centuries after the original Epicureans, and they thought some of the things the Epicureans thought, but mixed them with other things. When the same philosophy has different versions at different points in history, we put Neo on the beginning when we talk about a later revival, to remind us that it's different from the original. Bridger. Like Neoplatonism came after Platonism? Carlyle. You really know a lot. Wow. That won a little smile. Mycroft likes to talk about philosophy. Carlyle. Mycroft's a good friend to you, aren't they? Bridger. I like Mycroft. Carlyle. I know Mycroft likes you. Did Mycroft tell you about Epicureanism? Bridger. They say Epicureans think it's important to be happy. Carlyle. That's right. Epicureanism is a philosophy from 2800 years ago. Epicurus thought there was no afterlife, so the most important thing was to be happy in this life. But Epicureans didn't like quick pleasures like food and alcohol and love affairs, because after you've been drunk, you feel awful. Or when the love affair ends, you usually feel awful too. Epicureans focused on kinds of happiness that last a long time, like friendship, a beautiful garden, or thinking about philosophy. Bridger. Not pretzels? Carlyle. Pretzels are good, but they aren't going to make your whole life happy. Just a few minutes while you eat the pretzel. They're a temporary good, instead of a permanent good. And if you eat too many pretzels, it can make you sick, and then you'll be less happy. Bridger. I want to test that scientifically, he grinned. Can we do that next time at Science Club? Test how many pretzels it takes to make you sick? It was Thisbe he looked to for permission. Can we ask Dr. Weeksbooth? Thisbe chuckled darkly. I don't think so. Dr. Weeksbooth wouldn't want to run an experiment that will make everybody sick. But I bet we could ask them to do a lesson on the digestive system, so you can calculate yourself how many pretzels it could hold. And then I can eat one less than that. Carlyle smiled as the happy tangent eased the boy's fidgeting. Science Club sounds fun. It is. Last week we learned about siphons, and we made a goop siphon that siphoned with no tube. Impressive. He caught the boy's eyes. It sounds like you learned great things with Dr. Weeks Booth.
Yup.
Now do you want to learn with me about how Neo-Epicureanism and Epicureanism are different? Reframed like science class, this death discussion wasn't quite so scary.
Sure.
Neo-Epicureanism is an economic philosophy from only 300 years ago. So how many years newer is that than Epicureanism? The boy hummed tunelessly as he racked his memory.
I forgot how old the first one was.
2,800 years old.
Then the new one is 2,500 years newer than the old one.
That's right.
That's easy.
He looked to Thisbe for an approving nod and got one. Neo-Epicureanism says that whether there is an afterlife or not, people are healthier, more productive, and live longer if they're happy. So the government, for us the hive, should try to make sure people live in ways that make them happy. Living in a bash with a group of friends that you have fun with every day is one of the institutions the Neo-Epicureans promoted to help people be happy. The original Epicureans probably would have liked the bash, and their ideas helped it spread, but they didn't come up with it. Regan Makoto Cullen came up with it, based on Brillism, which is another fairly recent philosophy. I smiled as I watched over Thisbe's tracker feed. Some people talk down to children, as if they assume a small body houses a small intellect. Some people talk past them, bludgeoning them with unfamiliar words until the kids accept what they can't understand. Chance, or providence, whichever you prefer, had sent Bridger a sensei who treated the child as an equal intelligence, just blessed with newness, ready for difficult things, so long as they were presented honestly. And Epicureans think it's good to die? The child hugged his dog.
Man.
No, but ancient Epicureans thought it wasn't bad to die.
Child.
Why not?
Man.
Because they thought death was nothing. And there's no reason to be afraid of nothing, since it won't hurt you. It's just nothing.
Child.
But there's no more you.
Man.
That's true. Do you think that's bad?
Child.
Of course it's bad. You can't be happy anymore if there's no you. You can't eat, or have parties, or a dog, or play, or have a pretzel ever again. I don't like that. I don't want Pointer to not get to do that anymore.
Man.
But if you're dead, you also can't be sad, or in pain, or hurt, or lonely.
Child.
That doesn't make up for it. I like me, and I like gardens and my friends. I think everybody likes themselves and their friends. How could they think it's not bad to lose all that? I think they're stupid, Epicureans.
Man.
I don't think they're stupid, but I do think you have a very reasonable objection. There are many answers to your question when you ask why they thought death without an afterlife could be good. One possible answer has to do with how different life was back then.
Child.
What do you mean?
Man.
Epicureans thought of pleasure as the absence of pain. That is, when you aren't hurting or angry or sad or lonely or anything else bad, that's pleasure. It's what we call a negative definition, defining something by what it isn't rather than what it is. Like clean means something isn't dirty, and dark means there isn't light.
Child.
But pleasure is when you feel happy or good.
Man.
That's a positive definition, saying what it is, not what it isn't. They used a negative definition instead.
Child.
Why?
Man.
A lot of people think it has to do with the difference between what life was like in ancient Greece and what life is like now. Nowadays, life is pretty good, don't you think? You aren't in pain very often, or sick, or hungry, or alone, and you don't have to worry about your home getting smashed or your friends all getting killed by raiders. He frowned in sympathy as the boy hugged his dog tighter. in ancient Greece, life was harder than now. There wasn't enough food. There was war a lot. There were lots of diseases, and they didn't have good medicine, so doctors couldn't fix things. A lot of people were in pain and hungry all the time, and afraid of getting conquered or enslaved, and everyone had to see lots of friends die. If you weren't hungry or thirsty and weren't sick, and no one was hurting you, and you weren't sad from having a friend die, that was very rare and good. So they thought of that as pleasure, a state with no pain. Can you see how that would make sense in their world? Bridger half buried his face in the blue fur, sad at the thought of lives so hard. I guess, yeah. That's sad to think, though. Man, yes, it is. But if death also meant that all that stopped, no hunger, pain, or sadness, then, by the negative definition, death was also pleasure. Child. Then, why didn't they all just kill themselves? Man. Some people did back then. But the Epicureans say that you should still try to be happy as much as you can in life, in simple ways that are hard to destroy, like conversation or thinking about philosophy. You can do that even if you're sick, or alone, or lose your home in war. The boy's jaw set, his serious face adorable in its effort to imitate his battle-wearied guardians. The major and the soldiers in Mycroft told me what war is like. They say it's the second worst thing in the world. Man. That's an interesting definition. What do they say is the worst thing? Child. Not having anything worth fighting for in the first place. The sensei looked again to the frowning major and his men, thinking ahead perhaps to their future sessions, as Bridger gave him this first sample of a veteran's mind. Man. That's a very powerful thought. Child. Yeah. But we don't have to have war anymore. Life is good. Good enough to be worth fighting for, but we don't have to fight. No more countries, no more armies, no more war. Carlyle nodded. I bet your little soldiers still have a pretty tough life, being tiny and not being able to go out into the world and meet people, and remembering the war and friends that died in it. I bet Poynter had some bad things about their life, as well as good things. Child. I guess so. Man. So, before you do anything, you could think about whether those bad things might be enough to make it better not to bring Poynter back. Hints of pain made Bridger's voice grow weak. I don't know. Carlyle took a deep breath. Bridger, are you sad now? Child. Yes. Priest. Why are you sad? Because Poynter's dead. He buried his face fully in Boo's fur, the dog no longer big enough to shield the growing boy completely as it had the toddler. It made everybody sad. Me and Thisbe and the Major, everybody's sad when their friends are dead. Even Mycroft. To my astonishment, Carlyle's eyes too grew wet with mourning for this plastic soldier he had never met. Or perhaps the tears were grander, for the countless lost souls of the past, whom time had taken from us. Something shifted in his posture, marking some new phase of dialogue, now that he had pushed the child this far. Priest. What does being sad feel like? Child. It hurts. Carlyle leaned close. Bridger. Poynter loved you, didn't they? The boy wiped his nose on his sleeve. Yes? Priest. Poynter was a soldier, too. They loved the other soldiers, and worked hard for you and them, did hard things, risked their life. Poynter was willing to endure all kinds of pain to help you and the other soldiers, right? The major smiled a self-satisfied smile here. as if he smelled meat in the argument at last and saw its end. Child.
Yes?
Priest. Did Pointer sometimes give up doing something nice and fun, like resting, to do something hard and not so fun for you? Child.
Yeah, lots of times.
Like being on watch when it was really cold. Priest. So Pointer would choose to give up pleasure and face pain for you? Child.
Yeah.
Priest. Then, even if death is better than being alive, do you think Pointer would be willing to be alive again to help you and the other soldiers? Child.
Yes,
the child answered. Yes, Pointer would want to be here to help us. Even if death is nice, they'd still want to be here to help us. So then it can be okay to bring Pointer back, even if death isn't bad. Bridger smiled at last, and I felt the warmth of the conclusion spread through myself as well. I am no censor. In Carlyle's place, I would have just said that death is bad and that of course he should bring Pointer back. But that would have brought a world of pain upon the child. Do you still not see it, reader? The moral consequences 10 steps further along, which Carlyle foresees as clearly as signposts on a road? If Bridger had brought Pointer back on the theory that it's always better to be alive than dead, then what about the other plastic corpses lost somewhere in the trench dust? He should bring them back. What about Emma Plotz, Leslie's parents, the recently deceased censeur Carlyle replaced? What about the stranger who died yesterday in a hospital on the far side of the world? Or every stranger, every death, back to the dawn of time? Soon the nightmare guilt that sometimes kept me up at night would kindle in the boy, and make him feel that every single soul that ever died was on his conscience for not resurrecting them. But this way, deciding based on what the soldier personally would want, Bridger could bring Pointer back and still reserve the possibility of death being okay, and not take up the burden, yet, of saving all of us. At this point, I sent my silent signal to Thisbe and the Major that I thought this censeur could be trusted. But what if there's a god? Only a child could ask so bluntly, reader. I will spare you the next part. You may assume that Carlyle stayed with Bridger in the garden for another hour, leading him through the hypotheticals of Nirvana, Gehenna, Guinea, Mictlan, Hell, of nothingness, of reincarnation, of souls returning, souls merging, souls evaporating, no souls at all, presenting many options and leaving many open doors. Their conclusions were neither solely Bridger's nor solely Carlyle's, but discoveries made striding hand in hand through theology's well-trodden ground. When I returned that evening to find Pointer alive and well among his comrades, with no memory of his dead hours but a sleep-like sense of warmth and darkness, I thanked Carlyle in my heart for Bridger's smiles. Carlyle is gentle, reader. I am not. As you follow me to President Ganymede's party and the truths beyond, remember that as your historian, I cannot let kindness restrain me when I choose which doors I open for you and which I close. Chapter the 10th. The Sun Awaits His Rival. I give you the Renunciation Day party of Ganymede Jean-Louis de la Trémouille, Duc de Thouars, Prince de Talmont, President of the Humanists. Versailles was not so gilded, Paris so chic, Hollywood so glamorous, nor Babylon so infamous as the town of La Trémouille since the Duke's return. The French nobility was officially disbanded on June the 23rd, 1790, but nostalgia is more powerful than any law. So, when this young stranger bought up a clump of lots unworthy of the name estate, and declared himself to be the Duke returning to his ancestral lands, the locals rejoiced at this opportunity of fame and tourism. The line of Dukes de la Trémouille officially died out some centuries ago, but there are always bastards and lost cousins waiting for a fortuitous conjunction of wealth and DNA testing to reinstate them. The family home had not survived, so the Duke built a fantasy palace, period in style, but too opulent. The gilded woodwork too elaborate, chandeliers too huge, halls too labyrinthine, fields of sculpture and topiary stretching too far beyond what the eye can take. So stunning is the ostentation of the place that Ganymede's fellow humanists have forgiven him for spurning the hive capital of Buenos Aires to remain here in what was, until the Duke's arrival, European turf. Photographs taken at La Trémouille are blurred by too much light, recordings ruined by too many happy voices, but to stand there blinded by a world of unbroken gold is worth the fortune one must spend to get there. It always costs a fortune, reader, for if time is money, then the hours spent gaining influence enough to receive an invitation means that every guest has paid a fortune. Only Ganymede is not drowned out by such a backdrop. No thread of fabric touches the alabaster of his skin that is not silk or finer, and no cut of garment graces his figure that Louis XIV would not have worn. His cuffs drip with lace. His waistcoat swarms with embroidery, a monarch's costume to make Dominic seem the servant that he is. The Duke wears no colors but gold, ivory, or sometimes blue. But even true spun gold seems somehow pale beside his golden mane, which shimmers like the sun around his shoulders. The blue of his eyes is beyond sky blue, beyond sea blue, beyond amethyst, a ferocious blue like the blue of diamonds and star sapphires. The Hope Diamond, the Star of Asia, gems who leave behind a history of murder. Clothed so, he embodies the age when a peasant, glimpsing such beauty through the window of a passing coach, might think that all his toil is worthwhile if the sweat of his back allows so noble a creature to grace the earth. Nude, he is a god. Mycroft, good, walk with me. I want to talk with you. The Duke spoke French with me, the leisurely, satisfied French of one tired of pretending he is not bitter at his hive for preferring Spanish. Yes, Your Grace. The Duke President led me along one of his long galleries, where masterpieces jostled for space on the damask-paneled walls. The party was young yet, a mere few hundred notables chatting in corners, or listening to echoes from the great hall where Ting Ting Foster teased the Royal Belgian String Quartet by constantly segueing from one aria into another, forcing the strings to shift course like children behind a fickle kite. "I spoke with Oconsanir today," the Duke President began, pretending to scratch his cheek so the lace of his cuff veiled his mouth from lip-readers. "Apparently you were at the house during Martin's intrusion."
"Yes, Your Grace."
"Was Martin cooperative?"
"Very cooperative, Your Grace.
Martin is offering every courtesy and taking every opportunity to avoid establishing any bad precedents."
"But not so with Seneschal."
I struggled to keep my voice soft. "Dominic came to the house?" The Duke paused to smile at a trio of humanists who had strayed close enough to eavesdrop, but dispersed like startled pigeons at his glance. How magnanimous of the President, they must have thought, to grant a glimpse of heaven to this lowly servicer.
"Mercifully," he continued, "the only person that bloodhound saw was Leslie Sanier, but I'm not happy having any of my people exposed to him, especially not the Sanier Weeksbooth Bash. That's why we're going to settle this ourselves."
"We, Your Grace? I'm lending you my ears and eyes tonight.
You will channel my tracker through yours. See and hear what I see and hear. I need you to tell me whether Sniper is behind this.
Sniper?
The thought, obvious now, had never crossed my mind.
It's not impossible.
The Duke President nodded. I wouldn't put any stunt past Sniper. If this is just the prank of some enterprising mafioso, then Occam and Martin can take care of things. But if Sniper did this, I have to know. I'll give you a nice close look. Show you the expression Sniper won't show the cameras, then you'll know.
You place too much stock in my abilities, Your Grace.
He turned his back, the bright tails of his pleated frock coat almost brushing my knees. You know no one listens when you say that, Mycroft. You may rest in the kitchens as you watch. I'll summon you to report when the party's done. You don't have to be absolutely certain, but your best guess will be sufficient. Give me a direction to set my own hounds. I shall do the rest myself.
Yes, Your Grace. And Mycroft, he called. If anyone asks, I called you here to look for cheaters in the betting pool. Tell no one you spied for me tonight. Not Ancelet, not Spain, not Ando, not Caesar. No one.
Your Grace, if a certain person asks, make sure that doesn't happen. We have to bury this, Mycroft. His eyes flashed their diamond, deadly sparkle. I don't need to point out that if the public eye turns on that bash, it will mean the end of your comfortable little arrangement with Thisbe Sanir.
I squeezed my hat, comforting in my hands like a child's doll.
I know, Your Grace. I'll do my very, very best.
Good.
Now, off to the kitchens with you. Sniper won't show until I've gathered enough notables in one place to set up a worthy entrance.
I was well installed on my stool beside the ovens by the time the Duke President reached his first targets, whom he had spotted in the Salon de Conquête. There was already a crowd within, but as he entered, President Ganymede pressed a finger to his lips to silence all who spotted him. The lesser guests knew what he must want, and left the Duke a clear path toward Cousin Chair Briar Cosala. She had shed her costume from the Pantheon, and was back in a cousin's wrap, this one less a robe than a chaos of marbled scarves, a dozen shades of green, whose silk-soft chaos made her, if not the most elegant of the present elite, certainly the most comfortable. Censor Vivian Ancelet stood behind her, back to back, still in his purple uniform, the couple trying not to feel awkward among the evocative masterpieces in the aptly named gallery. In stone, in oil, in chalk, the room was crammed with first knights. Antony and Cleopatra, Romeo and Juliet, Achilles and Patroclus, Don Juan with a variety of beauties. Jupiter appeared in his many amorous transformations, the bull carrying off Europa, the swan coiled suggestively between Queen Leda's thighs, and the shower of gold descending to impregnate the ancient princess Danae, locked in her father's tower. These were not innocent nudes, nor even half-innocent, like a classical Aphrodite pretending to cover herself with an ineffective drape. These were all fully sensual, not yet in the actual act of sex, but so intent upon it, one could think of little else. Silent as a lion, which is as much a cat as any other, Ganymede prowled in between the silent pair. Reaching gently, he massaged Cosala's shoulder with his right hand, while with his left he stroked the underside of Vivian's palm, as lovers do, inviting one another to hold hands. Neither victim glanced back, but both smiled at the touch of gentle fingers, Chair Cosala arching her back while the censor grasped the president's fingers, soft as a woman's, and held them warmly. Ganymede pressed his luck, moving closer to Briar until their flesh shared heat, then craned his neck to let his breath reach between the dreadlocks that tickle Vivian's bare ear. Only then did Cher Casella turn to see why one of her bodyguards was trying so hard not to laugh. She almost screamed, "Ganymede!" She and Vivian gaped at the Duke between them, who smiled, looking as smug as the sculpture behind him of naked Hephaestion, basking in the hungry gaze of Alexander. In fact, since Duke Ganymede himself had been the model for that particular Hephaestion, the likeness was exact. "You see," he lectured, "this is why couples should stand together in this room, not apart." As the pair stood frozen, Ganymede gave each kisses on both cheeks, then pressed them into one another's arms as if arranging dolls. "Like that. See? Better." They held the pose only a moment before balking back. "Ganymede," Cher Casella began, "we were looking for you." "Then it was mutual. Come, there's something waiting for you on the Ruby Walk." He seized Cher Casella by the hand, the lace of his cuff mingling with her hanging silks like the leaves and blossoms of wisteria. "Something for your bedroom wall." Pure Indian ancestry has made Briar Casella's hair as rich and dense a black as any on the planet, almost dense enough to hide behind. "I thought you'd forgotten about that." "Dearest Briar, I never forget anything. Come along, Vivian." He dragged the censer by his gray law sash. "Briar's not going to use this piece alone." Ganymede swept out of the salon with the speechless couple helplessly in tow. The long main gallery they entered now had a sleek, reflective red carpet, which preserved the tracks of humanist boots, no two alike, whose custom soles stamped the receiving fibers with the sigils of many athletes, actors, thinkers, and tricksters who played the celebrity game well enough to walk Ganymede's halls. The boot design is nearly 200 years old, created when the Olympian hive, which lived for sport, merged with World Stage, which lived for concert and spotlight, to form the humanists. A hive united by the passion to excel, achieve, improve, and constantly surpass the past limits of human perfection. I believe there has never been, nor shall be again, a government as stable as the humanists. Rome grew mighty under kings, then stifled as they became tyrants, forcing the bloody revolution which birthed the republic. When that republic's conquests outgrew the Senate's power to govern, it took a second bloodbath to return to monarchy. How many bloodbaths has France endured? India, China, Florence and Athens, trapped in their constitutions, unable to switch to monarchy when crisis demanded one voice. The humanists alone have escaped this cycle, trusting voters to choose not only governors but governments. Humanist elections have no short list of candidates. All may vote for anyone they please, and everyone who receives even a thousandth part of the voting pool receives in turn that portion of the power. Today, universally beloved Ganymede commands 63% of the vote, and so wields 63% of the powers of government, and adds president to his list of titles. The other 37% of the power is distributed among his rivals, 22 and the title of vice president to the runner-up, 6-1 minister of justice, the final 9 to a council of minor celebrities currently dubbed Congress. 50 years ago, when charisma was less concentrated in one star, the front-runner had boasted a mere 7%, and the title speaker, while 3%, went to a vice speaker, and the remaining 90 to a senate of more than 500 names. It was a revolution, reader. A transition from republic to dictatorship in 50 years without a single drop of blood. Detractors call it a cult of charisma, but the humanists themselves use aristocracy, rule by excellence. "Grand frère!" Danae's greeting rang through the halls like fanfare. She rushed to her brother, the sleeves of her kimono rustling like a flightless bird which flaps in its excitement, forgetting for a moment that it is Earth's prisoner. The view through Ganymede's tracker camera was stunning as she threw herself into his arms, rivers of spring blooms flowing across her silks like a florist's window, with many more colors than mere rainbow. Danae rained kisses upon her brother, and the sparkles traded back and forth between their silks made the scene almost blinding. Such scenes are even more powerful in person, seeing the twins' eyes lock, the same gem-deadly blue, their hands intertwine, the same china doll fingers. Danae's cheek brushing Ganymede's mane, as gold as hers. Danae's station demanded that her hair be bound modestly back, though the sheer bulk of the coil dared one to imagine what ocean of sunlight would pour down if it were free. Her station also demanded that she not throw herself so enthusiastically upon another man in public, and her husband was not slow to place a firm hand on her shoulder.
"Hello, Ganymede. Thank you for inviting us again."
Chief Director Hotaka Ando Mitsubishi's voice was cheerless as old stone. His suit this evening was spectacular itself, a rich blue like deep water, whose winter pattern of fine spirals was halfway through transforming into the ripples of a rain-spattered spring pond, koi and turtles appearing through the blue as if rising to feed.
"The pleasure is ours."
The Duke crushed the orchid-fragile knot of Danae's obi as he held her tight. Director Ando pulled harder at his wife.
"Come, Danae. Let's let your brother breathe."
Smooth as a dancer, Danae peeled one arm off her brother and netted her husband in its grasp, forcing the pair to sandwich her in one affectionate embrace. The photographers went mad.
"I saw the ice sculptures out front," she shouted in her joy. "I can't believe that horse's tiny legs are strong enough to support its whole body. And Lady Godiva on top, and so much hair."
Ganymede let his head rest on his sister's shoulder as she held him.
"That's nothing. Wait until you see out back. The whole hedge maze is iced, so you can skate the entire course. And it's lit so the colors change every time you move, like skating on the Northern Lights.
Oh, we must have a race."
She gave her twin and husband each a fresh kiss before letting go. "Wouldn't that be marvelous? I bet I can make it through the whole maze faster than either of you." The gentleman exchanged a chuckle.
"Come, come, let's race."
Her eyes pleaded with her husband's.
"It would be such fun. And we can invite the others. His Majesty, Briar and Vivian, the Emperor and Felix. Can dear Felix skate?"
Ganymede peeled himself away just enough to tap the front of her obi, which bound her belly as tightly as a corset.
"And just how do you propose to skate in that?"
"Easy. I'll see which one of you is faster. Then I'll hold your coattails and have you tow me through. Then, at the last second, I'll distract you and pull ahead to victory."
"And how will you distract us?"
Smiling, Danae threw both arms around her husband and locked him in a kiss, while at the same time her left foot snagged Ganymede by the ankle and toppled him forward. With both still stunned, she flitted aside, quick as a hummingbird, and let her brother fall into her husband's arms. His Majesty Isabel Carlos II laughed. Danae had blinded the others as the King of Spain arrived. There are few people in this world whom Ganymede does not hate, but the Duke reserves a special hatred for the King. Isabel Carlos II is not the offender, nor is any Spanish king, nor any Spaniard. Ganymede's fellow Frenchman birthed the grudge. No line so noble as his cannot boast royal blood, and with wealth, fame, and his golden presence, Ganymede is worthier than many past pretenders to France's throne. But there is no throne for Ganymede. France killed its king in our very own 18th century, and what few kings it has tried on since, it discarded, like a grown man no longer comfortable in childhood's clothes. If he tried, Ganymede might convince as many to call him Your Majesty as now say Your Grace,
But what would it mean when every member of the French nation-strat is more loyal to the Marseillaise than to the memory of Charlemagne? The Duke knows he cannot tame France to monarchy once more. That, I think, is why he lets the world call him by the celebrity nickname Duke Ganymede, rather than his preferred title, Prince de la Trémouille. Prince has enough of Machiavelli's stink to make a free man balk. And even if he could win France, she spread her contagious liberty to Europe too. King Ganymede I of France would be as voiceless in the European Parliament as the queens of England and Belgium are, or the Japanese emperor among the Mitsubishi. Not so Spain. While the French monarchy lay dead these 6 centuries, the kings of Spain have been peacemakers and power brokers, kindled democracy from the ashes of tyranny, shared the podium with Thomas Carlyle, and caught the dying words of Mycroft Mason. Isabel Carlos II would have but to offer his name on the ballot for every European strat from Swedes to New Zealanders to rally to make him prime minister again. Well, if Ganymede sought power in Europe, he would have to fight for it tooth and nail, like a mere Casimir Perry. I cannot say whether President Ganymede actually feels himself entitled to a crown. But it is certainly the presence of the King of Spain which forced the Duke to choose the humanists, not Europe, as his kingdom, and La Trémouille, not Paris, as his capital. That he will never forgive. Your Majesty? Danae bowed stiffly, as a Mitsubishi ought. Which of these two do you think would be faster at ice skating? Spain smiled his modest smile.
If you mean to win, Princess, you should ride the coattails of the one who built the maze.
Of course. She turned bright eyes on Ganymede. Grand frère, you will introduce me to your gardener? He cuffed her gently on the forehead. Cheater. All laughed together, and the twins exchanged fast French. In fact, between the English and flirtation, you must imagine French fluttering back and forth between the pair all evening. Birdsong, sibling chatter, too quick for even Spain to catch.
Oh, good evening, Chair Briar. I didn't see you there.
The king nodded his respects.
And the Honorable Censor, how are you both?
Chair Casala had retreated into the crowd to avoid the glitter, but stepped forward now, dragging Vivian with her.
We're very well, Your Majesty.
Ganymede stepped in.
We're about to view a new piece these two might take home with them.
He offered the king a smile as sweet as the sugar coating around poison.
Would Your Majesty care to join us?
There is always a hesitation when His Majesty addresses Ganymede, as if he considers each time which style of address to use.
Why, certainly, La Trémouille. Lead on.
Lead, Ganymede did. Each step printing his own graceful signature into the carpet surface, an elaborately framed linear rendition of his coat of arms, 3 eaglets surrounding a chevron.
Hopefully the bookies didn't swarm any of you too terribly as you arrived. They're out in full force.
I know, begging for hints about the lists, as if we knew anything.
Danae hung on her husband's shoulder.
The children practically had to beat them off of us.
Vivian, I imagine it was worse for you.
Oh, unbelievable, Chair Casala answered for her spouse. The way they swarmed, it was as if they thought they could absorb the lists from Vivian by osmosis. Her chuckle warmed the company.
Danae hid her reaction behind her sleeve.
I hope they'll flatter off when the official odds are set tonight.
Grand frère, how long until the announcement?
21 minutes.
And here we are.
Is that not the most tender thing?
It was an oil piece, Cupid and Psyche. Most artists choose to depict the moment of their final reunion on Olympus, or the earlier moment of betrayal, when curiosity drives the girl to break her vow not to try to see this mystery lover who comes to her only in darkness. But this artist did not show triumph or betrayal, but an earlier moment,
when the lovers were still nestled in each other's trusting arms, with yet no taste of sorrow. Psyche's eyes were gently closed, while Cupid's were covered by what might have been a slim, dark mask, but in context was the blindfold which artists sometimes have love wear. The painting was also